I've been teaching for a long time, and it's been a long time since I ever felt nervous in front of students. But somehow, standing here in a temple, behind a podium, with a microphone, without my handy PowerPoint outline up there, it just feels a little different. So just give me a couple minutes to settle in as I try to preach the Unitarian Gospel. On July 2nd, 1776, delegates from 12 of the 13 colonies voted to declare independence from Great Britain. Apparently, even at this early date, New York just had to be different. So New York, about a week later, finally voted for independence and made it unanimous. But back on July 3rd, John Adams wrote a letter to his wife, and he sounds a bit prophetic, more or less. "The second day of July, 1776, this is John Adams speaking, will be the most memorable epoch in the history of America. I am apt to believe that it will be celebrated by succeeding generations as the great anniversary festival. It ought to be commemorated as the day of deliverance by solemn acts of devotion to God Almighty. It ought to be solemnized with pomp and parade, with shows, games, sports, guns, bells, bonfires, and illuminations from one end of this continent to the other, from this time forward, forevermore." Like I said, he sounds a bit prophetic. He was correct about the pomp, the parade, definitely some shows, sports, a whole lot of illuminations. I'm not so sure about the solemn acts of devotion to God. We often skip that part in the name of three-day sales and blowing things up. But the biggest mistake John Adams made was the date. He said second day of July. That was the day we actually voted for independence, but the day we celebrate is the 4th of July, which happens to be the date written on the Declaration of Independence, which was a piece of paper announcing this decision to the rest of the world. So, since we celebrate July 4th, I'm going to take a look at the Declaration of Independence, talk a bit about its historical background, and also try to understand how it's been important throughout American history and pretty much down to this day. But first of all, I want to talk a little bit about some happy memories of my childhood. If you're about my age, you may remember Saturday morning cartoons as one of the happier moments of life, partly because there's no school and you can sleep in, but also because in an ancient period before you had Cartoon Network and Disney Channel, Saturday morning cartoons were about as awesome as it gets. But the problem was we'd be watching, you know, this good mindless entertainment, Scooby-Doo, Plastic Man, the Super Friends, and then these adults would slip in this educational stuff. And they called these little cartoon music videos they would play Schoolhouse Rock. And some of you may remember Schoolhouse Rock. Little lessons about grammar, sometimes science, math, and occasionally American history. And one of the American history ones was called No More Kings. And I must have seen this thing 20 times growing up. And for a lot of people my age, I think that Schoolhouse Rock did more to shape their minds than any history teacher or history book, and that's probably still true into their adulthood. But the basic story of No More Kings was that you had this British king who in this cartoon looks kind of like a weird mutant. And this British king decides, because he's greedy and because he wants to show that he's still in charge, to start taxing these Americans like crazy. So he raises these taxes, takes almost everything they own, until the Americans finally get angry and rise up together and eventually overthrow this king. And it's kind of disturbing, but I show this cartoon to my classes to introduce the unit on the American Revolution, and I tell them, in about 2 weeks, when you get a test, don't repeat this. Now I show it to them, and I go through this whole spiel on the American Revolution, and then about six or seven of them give me Schoolhouse Rock on the essay question on the American Revolution, because I think it's very much embedded into their minds. The problem is, it's more really myth and propaganda than history, and it's also the same basic story you see in the Declaration of Independence. It's this classic good versus evil struggle. The problem is that reality tends to be a bit more complicated than songs and stories we give to our third graders. So were the British as bad as this cartoon depicts them, and as we often believe? And were the Americans as good as you see in this cartoon and in the stories we tell? So I'm going to kind of take a look at these questions. The Declaration of Independence has two basic parts. There's the part I'm sure that all of us have heard multiple times, which I'll read in a few minutes, where the Americans lay out this philosophic argument for why they've decided to make this big decision. But like I said, I'm going to skip that for the moment and talk about the majority of the Declaration, which is a big list of complaints of the American people listing a bunch of things the King of England had supposedly done to them to cause them to make this decision. But if you know anything about the late 18th century and what was actually happening, and try to look at it objectively, it's pretty clear very quickly that this list is very much exaggerated and inflated. And you could also make a good argument that today we are taxed way more, regulated way more, have a much bigger military presence than the American colonists ever had under Britain. So, if Britain wasn't actually all that bad, then why did the Americans, after 170 years of being colonists, decide to make this huge decision and break away? Now, that's a complicated question. And in my classes, I go through 6, 7, 8 possible reasons for why this revolution eventually happened. But I'm going to break it down to just a couple things, starting with the basic insight that American colonists were kind of a bunch of weirdos, kind of oddballs, strange people. And I mean that with all due respect. I mean that in a good way. One of our great strengths as a country historically is that we're a little bit eccentric and a little bit weird and very diverse. And a lot of Americans these days apparently have forgotten that. But it's easy to understand. If you go back to the colonial period and you figure, are average people facing average circumstances going to get onto a sailboat, sail across the Atlantic Ocean to plant a new life in America? You're going to tend to get, like I said, unusual people in maybe unusual circumstances. People who are a bit more adventurous than average might be willing to take a risk and head off to America. People who are unusually desperate, either very poor people who came here as indentured servants to serve a number of years as essentially a slave until they work off their freedom, they're pretty common. Or you might have people who are minorities in whatever country they're in. A persecuted minority, a persecuted religious group, Puritans in New England, Quakers in Pennsylvania, lots of others. So people who might be a minority in Europe, in some parts of the colonies, are a majority here. Also, a lot of these people weren't British at all. They were French, German, Dutch, Swedish, African. So you take this interesting mix of people, plant them in a land 3,000 miles away from Britain, in a geographic environment often very different from Britain, and over time you're going to see this new kind of lifestyle and culture form. And by about the 1700s, Americans start to realize this a bit, that they're starting to create a new society. They weren't quite sure what it was. I'm still not quite sure what it is, because we're a pretty young society. But there was a sense there is something different here, and not just different, maybe better, more innocent, more noble, not as corrupted as what you had back in England. Now, this is not enough to make Americans just wake up one day and decide to declare independence. But the fact that we are culturally different makes it a little easier, if Britain ever does anything to make us mad, to maybe walk away. In a sense, Americans were drifting away for decades anyway. So one factor, American weirdness. Second factor, it's not Britain so much being overbearing against the colonies. It's actually Britain for decades neglecting the colonies and really not governing them all that much. Taxes were virtually non-existent through much of the colonial period. The only taxes they had were on basically goods going in and out of the country. And Americans were notorious for ignoring the Navigation Acts, smuggling goods, bribing officials. And the British largely let them get away with it. Because believe it or not, we were not at this time the center of the universe. American colonies on the British sort of priority list, pretty much at the bottom. Top, Britain. Second, Europe. Third, probably Asian colonies. Fourth, Caribbean colonies. They're much more valuable than these 13. 13's on the bottom, so it wasn't really worth it to them to pour that much energy and resources into actually governing the place. So Americans pretty much governed themselves through much of the colonial period, and they were British colonies in a sense, in name only. And Americans like it this way, and they want to keep it this way. And so long as Britain keeps it this way, they'll stay happy colonists indefinitely. It's kind of like the British colonies are a teenager whose parents never really discipline them. And they get used to this, and they like it, until one day their parents watch some Dr. Phil or read a parenting book and decide, you know, I should actually maybe discipline these people occasionally. But the problem is the tone had been set for years. If you set that tone when the kid was like a week old, then you're good. If you wait till they're like 14 to lay down the law, it's over. And that's pretty much what happens in the American colonies. So, you've got these people who are a little interesting anyway, not really governed all that much, developing their own way of life, but they're happy with the situation. Eventually, though, Britain decides to change things. And it's not because the king woke up one day and said, I want more money, or I'm going to show these guys who's boss. The reason Britain changes things is because of a war. They fight a war against France, as they often did. And this war was a global war, but one of the big prizes was North America. And to make a long story short, eventually the British, with British soldiers and American colonists fighting side by side, drive the French completely out of North America. But there was a cost in terms of lives, a cost in terms of money. And now they had this bigger empire they had invested a lot into. So Britain decided to change things, to start to actually govern this place, and to start laying new taxes to raise some money to pay off the debts from this war with France. And when they start doing that, I think you know the rest of the story. And you get this series of taxes and regulations and the British troop presence and all the rest of it that causes these Americans to rebel. But Britain was just doing the stuff governments do. But Americans were used to being left alone, therefore they react very strongly against it and ultimately make that big decision. So, if Britain wasn't so bad, is it also true that the Americans maybe weren't so good? And to start looking at that question, I'm going to read the famous part of the Declaration of Independence, because no one's read this yet today, and somebody should. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute a new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Now, when you hear or read those words, you might have different reactions. Some people might feel these sort of patriotic emotions swelling inside them, visions of flags waving and songs playing, and appreciating the fact we live in a country based on such noble ideas. Others might hear it and say, yeah, right, and think about all the ways that our country doesn't remotely live up to these ideals. You might have visions of drone aircraft carrying out targeted assassinations. You might have visions of large corporations trying to buy elections through unlimited donations to super PACs. You might think of the country with the largest incarceration rate or the highest percentage in the industrialized world, and think of jails with lots of black and brown faces in them. Personally, I swing back and forth between these two extremes. I can have moments of great patriotism and moments of total cynicism. But mostly when I hear these words, I ask a bunch of questions. And it's easy to forget, if you've heard this a lot, how radical this little statement is right here. First of all, there's this notion that government exists to serve people, which might seem obvious. But if you go back through the history of civilization, it hasn't quite worked out that way. If anything, the people have existed to serve governments rather than the other way around. Anytime I think about one of these big, great palaces are monuments in history. You know, Versailles, Taj Mahal, pyramids. And the pyramids is the best example. What an amazing feat of engineering, the pyramids. And what a huge waste of time. I mean, think about it. It's this 500-foot hunk of stone that functioned essentially as a tomb, right? It's a tomb for one guy and his stuff, which is going to get stolen anyway after you put it in there. It's a waste. And if you want to think of a metaphor for all of human civilization, it's the pyramids. This massive base of people at the bottom sustaining the lifestyle of this tiny elite up at the top. That's the history of civilization, and some would say it's a history of the modern world. That's been the norm. The mass served the elite, not the other way around. But our country, according to the Declaration, was going to be different. The only problem is governments will always be flawed. They're just going to screw up. They're going to become corrupt. They're going to become self-serving. So the complicated question is, which is raised by this, is at what point does the government become bad enough so you have to rise up against it? And if you do rise up against it, how? Do you just do it through the ballot box, vote those people out? Do you march on the streets? Do you commit acts of civil disobedience? Or do you grab a gun and start shooting at government soldiers like the Americans did way back when? This is some radical stuff. And I wonder how many Americans really buy into this. How many of us would see it as patriotic to grab a gun and start shooting at American soldiers, which is how our country essentially started? So that's pretty extreme. The other questions that come to mind for me are one, equal. All men are created equal. What does that mean? Does that mean just some theoretical legal equality where we have equality of opportunity, supposedly? Or is there some economic component to that word? When it says we have the right to life, does that mean we have the right simply to not be killed or physically abused? Or does that mean we have a right to the necessities of life, a right to housing, food, clothing, or, as has come up this week, health care? Is that a right? Is that something you only deserve if you could afford it? And when it talks about a creator here, who's that talking about? If you read the Declaration, you can check me up on this, there are four references to God in the Declaration of Independence. This is the second one that I read to you. And when you read the first two, it sounds kind of like this deistic concept of God, a God who creates the universe, puts certain natural laws into place, and then kind of lets the universe go and leaves it up to us to figure out what these natural laws are, whether it's the laws of physics or the laws that govern how we should treat each other. It's kind of up to us to make it happen. Those are the first two references to God. But then if you keep reading to the less famous parts and get to the end, it talks about God as a supreme judge, and it talks about the concept of divine providence. And when you see those concepts, that sounds a bit more like a Judeo-Christian idea of God, who's actually kind of actively shaping events and punishing wrongdoers. So you kind of see a deistic and somewhat of a Christian one blended together there. So mostly I get questions out of this. The funny thing is, you can find people on both ends of the political spectrum, liberal, conservative, who will tell you they know the answer to all those questions. And they'll tell you they know the answer the founding fathers had to all these questions. Founders have been portrayed as everything from evangelical Christians and libertarians to secular humanists and to members of the ACLU. You can have people who put them into both of these categories. And people on both sides will claim that we've drifted over time away from the vision of our founders. We've gone too far to the right, we've gone too far to the left, as if the past was some golden age and we've lost our way. I have two big problems with this golden age idea. First of all, the founders were not a single entity. These guys disagreed on all these questions as violently as people often do today. The American people were hardly a united force. In the American Revolution, a significant percentage of people fought on the British side or supported the British. An even larger percentage of people did what I would have done. Don't take sides. Sit around and wait to see who's going to win. And then at the last second, jump in and say, you were rooting for him the whole time, man. It's like a fair weather sports fan, like a Celtics fan. You suddenly, 20 years of being lousy, and then you wake up and say, I'm a Celtics fan again. So that's what I would have done. So most Americans actually aren't patriots. And even the patriots, if you ask them point blank, what are you fighting for? They might give you the same words, but when you push them even further, they're fighting for something different. And they have a very different vision for what this country is going to look like once the revolution's done. The American Revolution's a civil war in many ways. And the big question wasn't just, are we going to get rid of Britain? It's what the heck happens after we get rid of Britain. That's always the complicated question in revolutions. The other problem I have with the Golden Age idea, America was no Golden Age in the late 18th century. Very few people in this room would want to live at that time. Wealth was highly concentrated, as it still sometimes is, but probably even more so. In many states, you had to have land, a certain amount, to be able to vote. It was a slaveholding society, a sexist society, a racist society. I mean, most of us don't fit the category of white male landholder today. So I doubt that the majority would want to live in the late 18th century. Here's a little quote from the Declaration that doesn't tend to get read on the 4th of July. This is a reference to Native Americans. He, meaning the king, has excited domestic insurrections amongst us and has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. Sound like terrorists. The good old days, man, when people understood what Native Americans were really like. Merciless Indian savages. A lot of my students, I'm sure, are convinced that my main goal in life is either to put them to sleep by telling stories of dead people or to depress the hell out of them by often poking holes in these various kind of myths and stories they're told as children and giving them kind of a darker side of American history. Isn't it more inspiring to just give our kids Schoolhouse Rock? Personally, I don't see it that way. In fact, I find the myths depressing. Because when you hear these happy stories about the past, suddenly the present seems really lousy. I mean, they had George Washington, Madison, Jefferson, Hamilton, Franklin. Look what we get. Romney, Cheney, Kerry, Pelosi, Boehner. That's who we get. But when you realize that people in the past were flawed, Washington, Jefferson, they were no saints. And when you realize the times they lived in were flawed, suddenly the present doesn't sound so bad. And in fact, in a lot of ways, it sounds better than what they had. A few weeks back, an African-American president announced that he was in support of gay marriage. Now, a lot of Americans might not be comfortable with an African-American president. Even fewer are comfortable with gay marriage. But the fact that this could actually happen is an indication of how much times have changed. Do you think Thomas Jefferson could have seen that coming? Black president supporting gay marriage? Might as well tell him about an iPhone. That would make more sense to Thomas Jefferson. But it shows, I mean, whether you think it's a good change or a bad change, it's change, which tells you that change is possible. Some people reading the Declaration would say it's just a bunch of words. We've never really upheld them. They never upheld them when they wrote the words down. But over the course of our history, we've become, in many ways, a better place. It's a better place for women. It's a better place for ethnic minorities. It's a better place for homosexuals. It's a better place for the disabled. And there are lots of reasons why these improvements have occurred. But one consistent factor has been those ideals expressed in the Declaration of Independence. Because that's one thing that's been consistent for 236 years. Many Americans, over the course of time, have looked at those words and tried to actually make them happen. So if nothing else, we can at least thank those founders for setting a higher standard for our country than has been the norm throughout history. That government should serve people, that people have individual rights. Yeah, it wasn't true when they wrote it, but it's a bit truer now in many ways than it was in 1776. So, in a few days, and by the way, there's one thing I forgot to say. Tomorrow is July 2nd, our actual day we declared independence, or decided to. So I recommend if you're supposed to work tomorrow, go to school tomorrow, don't go. And, don't offer any explanation either when you don't. And then when you come back, if your boss is mad, if the teacher is mad, and you lose a job or something, you know, figure it's okay, because at least you took a stand for historical accuracy. But then again, when you get to the real official holiday of July 4th, and you find yourself watching fireworks or eating hot dogs or whatever, if you're a person who very naturally feels very patriotic in those occasions, I would recommend that you run with it, because there are some principles worth celebrating. There have been millions of Americans over the course of time who have tried to bring those principles more into reality. Just don't make the mistake of confusing principles with reality, and don't assume that change always goes in a positive direction. But still, you know, there are plenty of things worth celebrating. But if you're a person who has trouble getting into the 4th of July, because you see the kind of what you might call a fantasy compared with the reality, I would say for at least one day, try to put some of that negativity aside. And remember the principles, even if we don't always uphold them, and how the principles have mattered to people over time, and how we have actually improved in some ways. And if progress happened in the past, there's no reason to think it can't happen in the future. So in closing, I'm going to read a little passage from a not very famous author named myself from a book called Accessible American History, which I published a few months back. And this is a closing paragraph of an essay on the 4th of July. The United States does not live up to its noble ideals. No nation ever does. So Americans should not simply rest on their laurels every 4th of July and celebrate how great we are. Ideals must not be confused with reality. This does not mean, however, that we should all become cynical and depressed because our country falls so woefully short. The United States, in spite of all its weaknesses and problems, has taken steps over the course of its history toward more closely realizing its creed. A recognition that revolutions never really end and that progress is possible should inspire all Americans to push our nation closer to those ideals that we claim to believe. Amen. And happy 4th of July and 2nd of July.